Good morning, ladies of Ireland, housewives. What's cooking?
Today's dish is called pork tropicana, and it certainly has a tropical feel about it. Mary went for baked stuffed salmon steaks with a garnish of mussels and a lovely tangy lemon and onion sauce.
Gina served pears O'Hare and decorated with cherries. A simple and once traditional meal from Angela, who served a rabbit casserole.
Wowzers, some very serious cooking. A clip there from Housewife of the Year, a new documentary exploring a competition that celebrated the work of women in the home. And yes, it was women. It began in 1968 and was televised and kind of had its heyday from 1982 as far up as 1995. Ellen took part in the competition because the prize was a spanking new cooker. She needed one.
The handle was loose in the oven because when you're opening the oven door, you have to give it a good hush, psh, pull. And it used to get loose and come off my hand, and my footprint was already on the door from kicking it, gently kicking, saying, mm-hmm. Oh, that bloody cooker.
And as she told Oliver, she won the regionals. She got the cooker. But this documentary digs a little bit deeper into the lives of the contestants, because Ireland was not always a good place in which to be a woman. And her story might just stop you in your tracks. When Ellen was 16, she went off for the day with some friends with the new camera her father had just given her.
Three young ones met three young fellas.
Yeah.
And we were all in the same choir, the church choir.
Oh, very good. Okay.
And they were our friends. Nothing to do with boyfriends or anything like that, but mm-hmm. we were just beautiful friends. And they went to the boys' school and we went to the girls' school. And one of them said, my dad's boat is there. Come on, hop in and we'll go for a row. So we rowed across to a little island.
And you're taking your nice photographs.
Yes.
And you go to the chemist, as you do, to get them.
It was my first time using the camera, so anyway.
Oh, it was the first time? Okay.
Yeah, and I had great footage.
Yeah.
With all the pushing and the pulling and the flirting. And they weren't our boyfriends. Well, nobody had boyfriends or girlfriends at that stage. So anyway, I handed in my strip of film to the pharmacist. That's what you did in those days.
Yeah.
And then you go back a week later and you collect them. But in the meantime, there was no prints.
No sign of the photographs.
No sign of the photographs. But in the meantime, he had taken the law into his own hands, the pharmacist, and crossed over to the canon and handed him the bundle of my photographs and said, you better do something about this one. So he was a really, really nice canon. And he was just a perfect priest and a beautiful gentleman. So obviously he did what this pharmacist put the gun to his head and said, go on, sort this one out. So he must have gone to my parents with the thing, showed them the photographs, and they said, look, they said, what do you recommend we do with her? So he said, put her down in the Waterford, Magdalene and Laundries in Waterford.
Wow. But her parents put her into the car.
My mother had a very strict face, and I knew with her face that I had done something very, very wrong. I was crying. I was in the back seat. I was told, pack my bag. There was a suitcase thrown up in the bed. They said, pack your stuff.
What was it like when you got there?
So we got there, and I didn't know where they were taking me. It was a very bleak, horrific, huge, austere-looking building. And there was this nun came out, very nice nun, and greeted me. And then my parents left without saying goodbye.
Wow.
No goodbye. No idea. Just dropped me in.
This great relationship you're having with your dad, and then suddenly you're coldly left there.
Gone. And I was left there, and I just continued crying and crying and crying until they filled all the pots in the kitchen. And it was a horrific experience. I can actually I have no memory of my food, or I have no memory of where I slept. But all I know is I had a kind of a prison uniform on me, and we marched through the grounds. I suppose the uniform would be in case you try to run away, that you'd be recognised as Magdalena.
Yes.
We did a lot of praying. Total silence, no contact with the other Maggies.
So you can't find out what you're in for, which might be the term.
Nobody would know, have known.
She would be there for a full summer. And when she got back, well, for her, things had changed.
When I eventually got home, all eyes were down and they were all... You could see that they were really sorry for me and heartbroken, that they missed me, you know.
Right.
But it was never spoken about. I never had
any... Never mentioned again?
No.
Just did your parents ever never apologise?
No. No. No, never mentioned.
Do you forgive them?
Well, you see, Oliver, the thing about if you are deliberately hurt and deliberately wronged, there is really no room for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course I've forgiven them, but strictly speaking, not really. Because it has stayed with me all my life.
And you still think the canon was a lovely man?
I do. He was. The gun was put to his head. The pharmacist probably kept checking. And you see, the thing about it is, my father was in business in the town, so, well, you know, that would have been another thing. You couldn't be bringing any disgrace on the business people of the town. Yeah.
My, oh my. Ellen, who features in the documentary Housewife of the Year. With Ray, another documentary. This time, Blind Boy, the Land of Slaves and Scholars.
I wrote this thing. I'm very, very curious about early medieval Irish history. I'm very curious about early Christianity. And I'm coming at it from the perspective of being an Irish writer. Like, I'm not religious. I don't believe in God. I view Catholicism as something that was kind of done to me in school. You know, I didn't ask for it. But I suppose the central question I have with this documentary is, like, Ireland's a tiny country. Absolute. We've half the population of London. But our cultural footprint is massive around the world, in particular when it comes to writers. The best writers in the English language consistently are Irish. And I wanted to find out, is early medieval Christianity, like the monks and the saints, does that play a part in the Irish writing tradition? And it does. It really does.
And Patrick, he may not have been the first, but he did have a pen.
Patrick was the first person in Ireland to ever write anything down on a piece of paper. That's what Patrick did. And that's why we know all about Patrick. And Patrick was the one who came here and he did a pretty good job at converting the Irish to Christianity. But here's the thing. What I like to look at is, yes, Christianity is a belief system, but it's a belief system that brought with it this brand new revolutionary technology of writing.
Hey.
That's a big one to get our heads around. Imagine showing a book to someone 1,500 years ago. Here's this thing full of pages and there's marks inside. And I can. So what Patrick did is he was able to go to the Irish kings who came from an oral culture. And he said to these kings, we can get monks to write your name in this book. And this will say that you own this land. And we can write in bits of the Bible as well. Yeah. So Christianity
they could literally write their own history.
That's what writing did. It gave power. And it also allowed society to advance a little bit more beyond what you could do with an oral culture.
And then they were off, leading to rival monasteries and monstrous egos.
Why were the saints' lives written by the monks?
I mean, it was a bit like Ireland, I suppose. See, Ireland didn't have towns. So when monasteries came with Christianity, that was the closest thing we had to towns. But the monasteries used to fight with each other. The monasteries used to go at war with each other. Hmm. So monasteries used to be like, we've got the best saint. And our saint can do, I'm serious, our saint can do this and do that. Yeah. The saints, it became like oral folklore. The saints became like Sean McCool. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
So we've got the best saint. And also, you know, our saint is buried here and people want to be buried here. Even the round towers that we grew up in school learning that the round towers were a way for the monks to escape from Vikings when they invaded. It wasn't. The round towers were just, it's like the spire.
Mine is bigger than yours sort of thing.
We've the biggest spire. Look how class my monastery is. Invest in this monastery.
Yeah, yeah.
And international tourism was a big deal too, because Ireland was seen as a very holy land. So, like, I went to St. Patrick's Purgatory up in Loch Derg. Like, very, very wealthy people in early medieval Europe would travel from France or even further to go into this terrifying cave up in Loch Derg, and they would visit hell. And that was St. Patrick's Purgatory. So there was a tourism industry too.
The Land of Slaves and Scholars. Certainly a different take on Irish history. And of course, it is on the telly. So would the bad boy of podcasting ever consider this?
Did you ever make the cover of the RT Guide, Blind Boy?
Never the RT Guide, no.
And it's not something you aspire to, I'd imagine.
I do not aspire to be on the cover of the RT Guide. That would, I don't think I belong there. Yeah. Ireland's Own. I wouldn't mind a cover of Ireland's Own.
I'd say that could be easier.
Ooh, and I was just about to phone you for the Christmas Guide. Oh well. Moving on. On Poetry People with Rachel Hegarty, a sonnet about football. Here's Cork poet David Nash, winner of the 2024 Seamus Heaney First Collection Poetry Prize for No Man's Land.
You have written an amazing poem about the GAA, and the title is nearly as long as the poem itself, so I'll leave you to introduce it.
Of course. All square at half-time in the Mid-Cork Junior A football quarter-final between Kennevy and Granat in Escara GAA grounds, 21st of August 2022. Something like the title of a poem that rivals in itself the poem's length. I want them to keep going, take heart in their parity, and draw forever. It's unbearable, all this hope. Yet 30-something men must bear it and play more. Sport makes extra time in that event, in a crack at infinity. There are Hail Marys, yes, and there are matrices with fewer permutations, although it's also simple. At each whistle, start again, make more decisions. It means you're strong if you hold out and hold your ground. But we don't go for hero worship. A muttered, you're a milk, would turn faster than Ono Driscoll, gets a laugh, since at this stage of the game, that's all you can do.
David Nash on Poetry People. The death of John Kenny was marked by many programmes this week, and rightly so. The comedian, actor and musician was described at his funeral as larger than life. Morning Ireland brought us this.
I know the fellas down there, and they're looking up here at me, and I know what they're thinking. What they're saying, what Timmy Ryan? Timmy Ryan is too hard on us. Well, I tell you something, lads, I'm not. You'll know all about it next year when you're playing under 14, right? So get out there today, lads. Go out there today with a bit of fight, a bit of spirit, lads. Go out there today with a bit of pride of wearing the blue and green of Glengooley on your back, lads. Take it back, lads. Go out there today, lads, and wear off them. Don't be afraid to break home, lads. There's plenty on the sideline, right? Let every blow be a funeral. I don't want to see you coming back in here with dirty jerseys. I want to see you coming back in here with bloodstained jerseys, lads. And go out there today, lads, and enjoy yourselves,
The late John Kenny. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, we're not entirely election-free here on Playback, no. More election-adjacent, and it was quite the week for leaders' debates. News hacks rubbing their little paws in glee. Christmas on top of birthdays. So, it was interesting, though, to get this perspective from the veteran political broadcaster, the late Brian Farrell, as heard on Bowman on Sunday.
I've often looked back on the days of the so-called Great Debate, and I thought at the time, and I'm still reflecting on it now, I think it was a little bit over. There was a little bit over-excitement. I mean, I regarded it as an important piece of television, but one shouldn't have regarded it as some miraculous event. I mean, in effect, we would have done it years earlier if the politicians would agree to the format. They wouldn't agree. And there was great excitement and too much excitement, I think, too much on it as a television event and not enough concentration on content.
But if you are watching and listening, here is an insider's perspective on tactics.
One of the reasons why interviewers have to interrupt so often is that the politician or the trade unionist or the bishop or whoever it is you're interviewing who knows a bit about television will try and fill the space to prevent you asking the questions people want asked.
Ooh, keep your ear out. And with Joe on Liveline, canvassers. Here's Dolores.
Most people are just so lovely, Joe, and you very rarely get somebody who is out and out, sort of.
That's good. Isn't that good?
No, it's lovely. I think people are more engaged, actually, this time.
Wow, okay.
Ooh, that's heartening. But it would turn out that not everyone was open to the canvas, the knock on the door, no. Some had signs telling you exactly where to take yourself and put your leaflets.
Do you ever get such a specification, Dolores?
I did get one yesterday, Joe.
Okay, talk to Joe, tell me.
I don't know if I can say it on air.
Of course you can, of course you can. If you've,
I don't think I can.
Okay, well, give us a clue. It's not the F word, is it?
No.
No, you can't say the F word.
No. Well, I won't say it, Joe, really, because it's just that no election bleep. And have a nice day. So, you know, you have to smile at some of it. And you respect it too, Joe. You're not going to, you know, they're having a bit of a laugh.
So someone actually wrote. Someone actually wrote. Was that a handwritten sign?
It was handwritten. And that's all people, you know, the way these okay. no-junk
And the
mails,
handwritten sign said no election. And then it wasn't a four-letter word. It was a five-letter word.
It was a five-letter word.
More suited to the bathroom in the house than any other part of the building.
You're trying to draw me out.
No,
there,
I'm
Joe.
Just trying to. I'm just trying to work out who would write that.
I don't want to lower the tone. No, I'd say probably a young person.
Oh, those young people with their tone lowering. But leave it to Joe, though.
We don't want any of your old rhymes with white.
Lovely, thanks, Joe. Let us now turn to a new addition to the schedule, our Divine Sparks. It started last night and is an exploration of our religious and spiritual life with presenter Dervyn MacDonald. And she spoke to Father Michael Collins about the small matter of a papal election, all very of the moment with the film Conclave coming out. And he spoke about a particularly fraught election back in 1268. It went on for 18 months until they were forced to take drastic action.
So the cardinals were all holed up in their houses waiting to elect a new pope, but they couldn't come to an agreement. The magistrates of the city decided a good idea would be to lock them all in a big room and get them to fight it out until they came to an end. And it didn't work. So the magistrates took the roof off the room where they were all meeting. And you can still go to that room. I've been there a couple of times before. And then they reduced their food gradually until the Holy Spirit prompted them into action and they elected one of their own number. Now, the Pope, who became Gregory the 10th, he decided, right, we've got to put this in some shape or order. So he issued a document called Ubi Periculum, where there is danger. And the danger was all sorts of things going wrong. He didn't want to put it in writing. That was the machinations of the cardinals, who were many of them holy, but lots of them corrupt. So what they did was they came to this arrangement whereby the cardinals would be locked cum clavis with a key into a room. And then if after 3 days they hadn't got anybody, then they would reduce the amount of food to one meal per day. And that might help the cardinals concentrate.
Certainly sharpen the senses.
Sharpen the senses. And then if after 5 days the Holy Spirit still hadn't done the work of electing a new pope, they reduced their eminences to bread and water. And strange to say, at the next iteration of a conclave, the pope was elected according to the rules. It had to be 10 days after the death of the previous pope. And the new pope was elected Innocent V on the 11th day.
That's one way to get a result. From our Divine Sparks, which started last night, well worth a listen. Now, though, to the German economy. Yes, I see you reaching for the dial. Don't, because this was really fascinating. Because if it's a toss-up between Boston or Berlin, it's a trickier choice than you might think. Because according to the former Financial Times Deutschland editor Wolfgang Munchau, the German economy is on the wane, a theory he sets out in his snappily titled book Kaputt, The End of the German Miracle. And his theory is that if you want to understand what's happening there, you need to look at the car industry and its massive political influence, and then what happens when that industry is floundering.
Is it fair to say now that this great success story, the legend of the German car industry, has now become an albatross? It's become a problem.
It's become a problem because the car industry has failed to spot the importance of the electric car early enough. They didn't make the investments. They were in denial. And it is interesting that the industry as a whole was in denial. It wasn't just one company. It was all the large companies. There was, you know, Germany has, you know, the Volkswagen Group, Mercedes and BMW. They were all in denial of this. They all underinvested, while China invested in electric cars. The US invested in electric cars, and they are now in a situation where they realize that this new car is not just a transitional technological shift, but it is very much a new product, where software, where battery, electric batteries matter. their traditional expertise is in engines and mechanical engineering. And this is much less valuable in the new world.
And that failure to keep pace with the digital revolution is reflected in this. Yeah, the fax machine.
They were the world champions of 19, you know, you could say the of 1980s analog technologies, and they really did this very well. And they still have extraordinary industrial capabilities, but they did not invest into digital technologies, both in the private and in the public sector. And that's why the economy as a whole is lagging in productivity. So it's not just a car industry story. This is just more of an example. But this happened also in the public sector. You see this in mobile phone systems. You see this in the prevalence of fax machines. In the German government, fax machines. Doctors use fax machines. The police, the army, the public service, they all use fax machines still.
I don't think anyone in Ireland has a fax machine anymore.
Nor do I. I wouldn't know how to connect to them anymore. But it's something, you know, there is a sort of a backwardness, a digital backwardness in the country that is quite astonishing.
And he puts all that down to this.
It's groupthink. And this is something that I've noted a lot of the country that I grew up in, that it has a tendency to have consensus views it holds onto for long times, and not much space for minority views that would challenge this, and they would usually get pushed aside. So if anybody said let's do digital, and you know 10 people in the room would say analog, then that's what they would do. There isn't a capital market. Germany has a very strong banking system, but not a very strong capital market. So it's not easy to bet against this, and you know, for entrepreneurs to say let's do something else and attract money, because the banking system would not support this. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a national consensus, and I think it's to do with sort of a not made at home, we distrust technologies. And in the beginning, there was also a little bit of an underestimating. This was like a toy. Mobile phones were seen as toys. The internet was seen as a fad that would go away. People still say that, oddly enough. And I think that's a cultural thing, that Germany as a country struggled with this technology that is not physical. And I think there was a general thing about something that needed to be physical, that you know it needed to move, and it, you know, you needed to have machines and tools, and this is a very different world.
So interesting. Wolfgang Munchau with Claire. Over a year on, and the war in Gaza continues. And this week, on Thursday, the International Criminal Court in The Hague issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his former defence minister Yoav Gallant, and a Hamas commander. On the News at One, Alistair Bunkle, Middle East correspondent with Sky News, joined Rachel.
What's been the reaction in Israel? Because certainly from what I've seen over the past short while, it looks pretty furious.
Yeah, very furious, both within the Israeli government, political society, including those in the opposition to Netanyahu, and amongst the Israeli public as well. It's been described as a disgrace, as anti-Semitic. The Israeli public and the government, when the arrest warrants were first sought quite a number of months ago, were absolutely disgusted, I think is, you know, an appropriate word to use, that Israel's leaders were being sought for war crimes alongside and in the same sentence as Hamas's leaders as well. We're yet to hear from Netanyahu. I'm told by his office there'll be a statement shortly, but it will be a very angry statement. He will reject any of the charges that are being leveled against him. And I suspect, as he has done before, he will accuse the court of anti-Semitism.
However, Israel does not recognise the International Criminal Court. So what practical application, if any, can there be?
It's going to be very hard to gauge. In theory, it means that Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant cannot travel to any country that is a signatory of the ICC, because it is beholden on any of those countries to then arrest them if they step on their soil. So we are talking the United Kingdom, Ireland, many other European countries, but significantly not the United States. In practice, that doesn't always happen. Vladimir Putin has an arrest warrant out against him for the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And he went to Mongolia recently, Mongolia is a signatory to the ICC and they did nothing about it. So it's up to individual governments how they react to this. And also, short of actually arresting Netanyahu, how they decide to conduct business with Israel's prime minister now that he has these charges against him. The one thing I would say that I think, you know, we can be sure of is, despite the protests that are inevitable from Netanyahu and Gallant, the fact is that the ICC, an international criminal court, has issued these arrest warrants. And unless either man were to stand trial and clear their name, they will remain on their legacy for the rest of their lives.
From Thursday's News at One. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Running around, people see places to go, things to do, not a second to spare. I am so very busy and important.
Anyone knows, no matter what gig you're in, you just feel that the pace of life has just ramped up. And I think, especially coming towards Christmas, we can feel that kind of heightened sense of overwhelm.
You're dead right, yeah.
It's a bit of an amplifier Christmas. You know, if you're feeling anxious or overwhelmed, I think it can really bring that out. And at the same time, you might be feeling guilty because you're not feeling Christmassy enough, you know. So I've been looking into the world of busyness, and actually it's something that I've come across since I stopped working full time on the radio, is that people will say to me, God, you're doing so great, you're yeah. so busy. And at the time, as they were saying it, I was like, I was only, for the first time in my life, I was only doing one thing and focusing on that, which was Bliss. And I was writing the book. And if I said, actually, do you know what? I'm not that busy. It would stop them in their tracks, because I've realized that not only do we reward busyness and wear it as a badge of honor for ourselves as a mark of our own success and productivity, but we dish it out as compliments to other people. You're doing so well. You're so busy. You haven't seen your kids in 2 months. The bags under your eyes just say success. You know, and that's the reality. And
it's slightly embarrassed not to be busy then.
Yeah, that people go, oh, maybe I'm not busy enough. I'm not slammed. I'm not flat out. I mean, if you think about it, the question used to be, how are you? And the answer was, fine, thanks. Now it's, how are you? Oh, jeez, don't talk to me.
That's right.
I'm crazy busy. I'm up the walls, slammed, flat out, up out the door, chasing me tail. And then we usually, there's a gap and we go, that sounds really unhealthy. So we throw in the classic, but you know, good busy. And you're thinking, yeah, that sounds like a really lovely nervous breakdown you're having for yourself there. How do I get some of the action? So I guess I've been looking at that.
Do not adjust your dial. Yes, that was Dermot Whelan, station hopping with Oliver, and he's on a mission to calm us all down. And on Sunday with Miriam, a woman whose life was, by her own admission, pretty hectic. Melanie Finn is a journalist with the Irish Independent.
It's like any other parent, you know, you're so busy. The juggle is a struggle. You're running around, you're doing a million things, you're multitasking. You know, there's 10, 15 plates spinning in the air any given day. And I was so caught up in the busyness of everything, of our life, I suppose. It wasn't until there was a very serious situation that I realised how sick I was.
She had started blacking out and falling.
I'd been kind of tired. I had a bit of memory loss, occasional double vision, and headaches. But they could be any number of things. You know, you're running around and, like I say, they came and they went. And then at the start of February 2023, I remember it because RTÉ were launching the Eurosong. So I was on my way to Montrose and I was doing the school run with the boys. And I collapsed, or I thought I tripped, is what I thought happened, near where we live. And I came to, I was in the middle of the road, and my two sons were on the road beside me looking down. And they said, Mammy, what happened? And I said, oh, I must have tripped. You know, I'm horrifically clumsy at the best of times. And I just kept on what I was doing. You know, there was no one else to take my young kids to school, so just kept on walking. But it was only afterwards I realised I was really dizzy, and I was kind of, I felt like I was going to get sick. And so I rang the GP and I rang work, and I got myself checked out, and everything came back fine. And so I just carried on as normal, as you do.
In June, she had a second fall, but again, she carried on. But then another fall, and then a feeling that something was quite wrong. She went to the Mater Hospital, A&E. They did a CT scan, and about 4 hours later, she met a consultant.
She said, we know what's wrong. and we know why you've been having these unexplained falls. They're not falls, they're losses of consciousness, blackouts in layman's terms. And what's wrong is you have something in your brain and it's full of fluid and it's getting bigger and you'll need emergency surgery maybe tonight. And I remember him being kind of triumphant because he said to me, it's a good thing that we found this because we normally see them in postmortems. So I did what any normal person would do. Like I burst into tears.
In the most basic of layman's terms, she had a cyst in the centre of her brain, which was stopping the movement of fluid.
And you're talking about something, I think from my discharge notes, it was about 3 millimetres. So not even the size of a pea, but it's where it was that was so serious. So although it was benign, it was life threatening.
But at the time, none of this was really making any sense to her. She certainly wasn't in pain.
And then I had to ring my husband, and that was really hard. So this is happening and we need to get a plan. You know, I need a bag. I had nothing with me. I had a chicken fillet roll, a water bottle, and I was in my gym gear. I had been admitted to the matter, but they had to wait for someone who was free to bring me to Beaumont. And I remember saying, can my husband not drive me? Like I hadn't processed it. And they were like, no, you need a nurse to go with you at all times. They're waiting for you in Beaumont Hospital. So it was nighttime by the time I got there. And I remember gazing around the ward. It was a high dependency unit and going, oh, and I'm in the wrong place. I said, these people are really sick. They're all hooked up to machines, you know, various states of consciousness, unconsciousness. And he said, Mel, I think you're really sick, you know. And then that was kind of the start of realization that there was something seriously amiss.
She needed brain surgery, a craniotomy, and as soon as possible.
I have to say, I've never been more terrified in my entire life. And you can do all the meditative thoughts you want and your yoga breaths. Sometimes you just have to admit you're absolutely petrified and sit in your feelings and feel your heart racing like it's going to come out of your mouth practically with the terror. And I remember one student nurse sitting with me, and it was about, I think it was about 6 a.m. And it's a really quiet place, the Richmond ward. You know, it's for people with severe neurological conditions. So no one's like bantering, so to speak. She just sat and she just held my hand. She was called Emma, and she said, you know, you're here because you're a fighter. You knew something was wrong. You felt it was wrong and you got it checked out. And that's why you're here and you're going to get better. And sometimes that's all you need to hear, you know. And I just think the public health service gets such a battering sometimes, you know, and you hear so many sad and unfortunate stories. I'm sure I've covered them myself. But in this instance, I just, you know, I was in complete awe of the medical staff there. I just felt, even though I was terrified, I was in the right place and everything was going to be fine. Even if I didn't know that was the case, I was going to tell myself that was the case. That was going to be my mind message. I was going to be fine. I was going to survive. And I was going to go home to my 3 boys and my husband.
And yes, she did come through the operation, but the recovery has been something else.
When you woke up from the operation, can you remember that moment? Can you remember what you thought?
When I woke up from the surgery, I remember thinking I was going to feel this kind of Hollywood-style wave of relief, you know, like a euphoria, like, oh, I did it. I survived brain surgery. Aren't I great? It's all over. And I didn't. I felt so overwhelmed. I felt like I was a stranger in my own brain. It's the only way I can describe it. I felt like I'd been run over by a bus. But the first face I saw was my lovely husband's, and I recognized him and he was there, and I was like, okay, I'm through that. But it was a far longer road to recovery than I thought it would be. I suppose, yeah, that's what I'd like to say is also, like, people might think now, like, oh, sure, she bounced back, or look at her now. Wasn't that, you know, an easy road? It was like, this is what, like 16 months after all that. It was horrendously long. And I suppose in terms of the recovery, like brain surgery is very nuanced, and you do the most recovery in the first 6 months. And then after that, It's so tiny. The gains are so small. And also, if you had a broken leg and you had a cast, people would instantly know, oh, you're recovering, you're not well. Mm-hmm. Whereas this was all invisible. So people maybe wouldn't understand, like, why I was hesitating or why I looked confused or why was I so tired or, you know, why wasn't I functioning like I had before? And it's because it's all invisible. So the tiredness levels was just off the charts. There was days and days where I could barely get out of bed.
And as she told Miriam, something like that changes you.
I try not to sweat the small stuff, but I think it's human nature to still sweat the small stuff. I also had a lot of people, you know, during the year of recovering say to me, God, you were very lucky, weren't you? And they don't mean it in any, you know, ill-intentioned manner. They mean it in a really nice way. And I didn't feel lucky. I still don't feel lucky. I don't think anyone who's had their life upended and gone through a really painful, difficult year of recovery feels lucky. I do feel fortunate. I feel fortunate it was caught, and I feel fortunate that everything played out the way it did on that fateful Friday when I went and got myself checked out. And it's like those sliding doors and you know, moments in your life. And I feel like it's a really hopeful story. It's about listening to your inner gut. You know, that thing that we don't listen to anymore because of modern day technology. We're all so, so busy, you know. And yeah, just listening to that inner voice that goes, hang on a minute, you better mind yourself because you don't get another chance.
Melanie Finn with Miriam on Sunday. Now, kids, listen up, because Owen McGee, personal finance expert, was all about the pocket money.
You were saying they should have a base level of pocket money, which they don't have to earn, and then the extras they get a bit more for.
Yes. And what I would say is the base level, it should be they're doing a base level of chores, right? But they're doing additional chores that are identified of that's the chores that you do every week to get your pocket money, right? So that you can see the reward for your time. And if they don't do their chores, they shouldn't get the pocket money, the same way as life works as well. The other thing you have to be careful of, Claire, is often, let's say you have an 8 and 10 year old, and the 8 year old is saying, why does the 10 year old get more money than me?
Yeah.
Think about that from a pay equality point of view. That's a really important lesson.
So how much then? How much is the right level?
And you see, my problem is if you've got kids listening to this, they're going to be saying to their parents, oh, McGee said I should be getting X, right?
Yeah.
And again, it's all relative. Yeah, they are. That's exactly what they're going to be doing. And oh, McGee said this, that's what I have to get mom or dad or whoever. There are some maths out there. I really think you should come to your own conclusion about what it is. Look at what you're paying for them anyway. What is it they're actually going to use the money? What behaviours are you trying to encourage? There are some people that say, €2 for every age, €1 to €2 for every age, right? So if you're 10, it could be €10 to €20 a week, €1 to €2 for
every... It's too much.
Yeah, so it depends.
Claire, but that's your baseline, kids. And then we had this text.
Mary, I gave the grandchild a talk on working conditions and introduced wages that were paid every Friday, €5 for all the jobs that needed seeing to. I have to say it has worked. In fact, one day I realised I'd forgotten to have a logbook I'd brought inside after paying the wages. I was reminded that this was classed as overtime and an extra amount would be due. That was from a 10-year-old. Is that what you want to see happen?
That's what I do want to see. And you know what? Don't always be fair to them because life isn't fair. So you say, yeah, that's fine. You did it and you might be entitled to overtime, but this is the rate you're getting, or you're not getting it this time, or just be very... I know it's hard and I know we all like to make our children happy, but I believe that our role isn't to make our kids happy all of the time. I believe our role is to prepare them for life.
Yeah, good point.
And life isn't always fair and it isn't always easy.
Ooh, harsh but true. But maybe, kids, you go join yourselves a union. Right, let's go to a little bit of this. Won't you just tell Cincinnati I'm gonna need your love? Don't you give me your love? Don't you give me your Simone? Simone, where is your love? Don't you give me your love? Don't you give me your Simone? Take a chance with my two. They can't find a way. You think that I could muster up? Scissors Sisters. Pull up to the bar, Jake Shearer's cocktail in your hand. Give us the goss.
How did you come to meet Elton John? Do you remember the first time?
Oh, fabulous. Now that's a question we can get behind.
He came to see Scissors Sisters early days with George Michael, Emma Bunton and Lulu, the four of them.
In a really small venue,
and he sat kind of directly across the stage, and instead of clapping, I remember he would kind of wave, you know, like a queen would wave at the stage, and I was sort of fascinated by that. And then the four of them came backstage, and he was just so sweet. He was so kind. And he ended up having Scissors on tour with him a little bit. We went and played his Oscar party in LA. And then he invited me and Baby Daddy to Vegas to come write with him for a while he was doing a Vegas show. And so that's what we did. We ended up flying to Vegas and writing on the stage of Caesar's Palace.
That was the day where the earth tilted on its axis. Such was the campiness.
Do not hold back. Next up, Gore Vidal.
Oh my God, yes. This gets so name droppy, it's ridiculous. this is so ridiculous. There was like a time in New York and LA where I was kind of hanging around Susan Sarandon a lot, and I love her. She's so sweet. And we went to the movies that afternoon with her and her boyfriend, and afterwards I was like, what are you guys doing tonight? And she's like, oh, we're gonna go hang out with Gore at the piano bar at the Ritz. And I was are you seriously talking about Gore Vidal? And she said yes, and she said, oh my God, he would love you, you've got to come with us. And we sat like one of the craziest nights of my life. He died a month later.
Yeah,
and he was sitting by, we were around a piano. I was seated next to him, and it was a time in his life where he wanted to sing. So we were singing. So we were singing along with this piano player and had this song book. And we ended up singing Unforgettable together by Nat King Cole. And it was just one of the strangest moments of my life. And he was so kind of feeble. And then he sang My Way, which just made me cry, of course. But Gore Vidal, I mean, come on. At times he during the conversation, he was like delighted by me. And then other times he was like disgusted by me. He really had like a...
He was a very conflicted man. Yes.
Intimidating character, you know.
What did he say to you about campness? Because there was a lot of talk about campness at the time.
This is my favorite thing he said. I think we might have been talking about the script for Caligula that he wrote or something. And he looked at me and he said, camp is just another word for someone who's got no talent. And I was like, that is such a great quote.
And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. Walking down the street and a man tries to get